Coming up, amid ongoing controversy over U.S. immigration policy, Lucky Severson reports on one state's success resettling refugees. And with the Advent season underway, I look at how music embodies the meaning of Christmas. Plus, belief in practice, churches packing meals by the tens of thousands for hungry children.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. U.S. Muslim leaders are strongly condemning this week's attack at Ohio State University, where nearly a dozen people were injured. The attacker was killed by university police. He was identified as Abdul Razak Ali Artan, who was born in Somalia and came to the U.S. in 2014. Authorities say Artan posted rants on Facebook about the treatment of Muslims around the world. American Islamic leaders said his actions were a perversion of their faith. They urged that the violence not set off a backlash against their community. Meanwhile, mosques in several states have been receiving copies of a letter referring to Muslims as children of Satan and asserting that Donald Trump will do to Muslims what Hitler did to the Jews. Interfaith leaders are denouncing the hate mail. Reformed Jewish leader Rabbi Joan Adolf Pessner called it vile. He pledged that the nation's largest branch of Judaism would stand with Muslims against Islamophobia. The Southern Poverty Law Center this week released a report documenting a sharp rise in hate incidents in the immediate wake of the election. The main targets were Muslims, immigrants, and African Americans. The group called on the president-elect to follow through on his commitment to bind the wounds of division in this country. A diverse coalition of clergy is urging President Obama, before he leaves office, to issue pardons to nonviolent prisoners with low-level drug offenses and to undocumented immigrants. In addition, the group is calling on city officials around the nation to declare themselves sanctuary cities that would welcome undocumented immigrants. The clergy say they're worried about policies that may be implemented by the Trump administration.
When either we try to detain or deport or and send people out of the country, or whether we throw them into prison through the tools of mass incarceration and the new Jim Crow, we are ultimately breaking up families that are fundamental to the bedrock of our nation. And so we need President Obama to do the right thing and to grant more clemency and release more people.
Also this week, more than 70 presidents of Catholic colleges and universities signed a statement supporting students who are part of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. The program was established through executive order by President Obama. It protects young immigrants from deportation and allows them to have work permits. During the campaign, Trump promised to repeal the order. More than 720,000 young people came forward to be part of DACA. They fear they will now be deported. There are many questions about how the Trump administration will change U.S. policy on immigration and refugees. Some 30 state governors have said they don't want to take in more refugees, especially from predominantly Muslim countries. Many of them cited fears that terrorists might be among the newcomers. But Lucky Severson reports that in the state of Utah, refugees are accepted and welcomed, and religious groups are active in helping them resettle.
This is not an uncommon sight at the Salt Lake City International Airport. Refugees arriving from all over the world to a warm embrace. Today, they're from Somalia and Nepal. Among those here to welcome them and help them is Martha Archuleta.
You've been here 2 years?
A volunteer with Catholic Community Services.
It's an opportunity for me to live out my faith. Christ gave us the example of caring for the poor and welcoming the stranger in our midst.
About 1,200 refugees will arrive here this year to a place that stands out, particularly among red conservative states, for its attitude toward refugees. They are welcomed here, unlike at least 30 other states that have said they are not welcome, especially those from Syria. That's where Khalud Abu Arida came from, along with her husband and three children.
Was it dangerous there?
Yes,
Yes, yes. And my husband two times went to jail. My children not safe for them.
Makes you wonder what's going on in their minds when they get here. Hayden Batar is the director of immigration and refugee resettlement for Catholic Community Services. There are over 60,000 refugees now living in Utah. He says there is an important distinction between being classified as an immigrant and as a refugee.
An immigrant is somebody who left their country on their choice for a better future and better life. A refugee has to show a well-founded fear of persecution based on religious persecution, political opinion, based on membership in a social group, you know, and so forth. So the refugees have to meet that definition in order for them to be given a refugee status.
Hayden himself is a refugee and a Muslim. In Somalia, he was a practicing lawyer who fled his country in 1996.
I left my home country, Somalia, because of the civil war that started back in 1990. If it hasn't been the civil war, I would not have left my home country. I was forced to flee after losing a family member.
States that don't want refugees are concerned that there will be terrorists among them, but Hayden Batar says that fear is unfounded. The vetting process, he says, is exhaustive. First, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees must determine that an individual or family qualifies as a refugee. That's a small percentage. Then the U.S. sends investigators to the camps.
Then they have to go to a screening process where they'd be fingerprinted, their names will be checked against a multiple database. The FBI, the CIA and can check those individuals to make sure they're not linked with a terrorist, to make sure they don't have any criminal background.
The process on average takes 2 years and longer.
I understand why people have the fear, but refugees are not the ones that are harming this country. Ever since the refugee resettlement program started back in the 70s, we have more than 3 million successfully resettled in the United States. And those refugees are contributing members of our society.
Back in Syria, Khalud was a teacher of Arabic in Damascus. Now she drives a forklift at the LDS or Mormon Humanitarian Center. She eventually hopes to teach here.
So scary, because everything here different. Culture, people, everything, and language, so hard. Yeah, but no, now, yeah, we love America. Yeah, and people here in Utah, very friendly.
Her husband is a chef. Their three children attend public school. This is Noor. She's 16.
I learned English so fast, and everything was quickly for me. I don't want to go back to Syria because I start my new life here. I saw my new future here.
For 4 hours each weekday, Khalud and about 200 other refugees work sorting out clothing to be sent around the world. Tomorrow is payday, so everyone is wearing a smile.
What time will you?
In the afternoon, they learn English and how to get a job.
Refugees, after 6 months they've been in the country, when they get their first job, they're required to pay back their airfare.
For Khalud's family, airfare cost $8,000. That's one reason there are classes like this one about personal finance.
If you get a job within the first 6 months, while we're paying your bills, save as much as you can, because tomorrow you're going to need a car.
The minute refugees arrive in the U.S., after being fingerprinted and another background check, they are given legal status to work, to go to school, and get benefits such as Medicaid. There's a furnished apartment waiting for them with furniture donated from throughout Utah. Everyone must learn English.
What will you say?
We do some things that are very practical with families, like teaching them the public transportation system, the grocery store, how to operate sometimes a washer and dryer. But our very most important role is being their friend and being a person that they can trust from the larger community.
People here say the reason Utah is so welcoming to refugees is because the early settlers themselves were refugees. They were fleeing religious persecution all across the country to get here. Their leader and many of their men were murdered. Because so many Mormon converts came from Europe, President Rutherford B. Hayes asked Europe not to let any more migrate. So people here do empathize. And it's not only Mormons.
Islam teaches us to love our neighbors, to love one another, and also to help those who are most in need. That's what my faith teaches me, and that's what I believe.
Emily Stevens is a Mormon. She worked for the Amar Foundation, an international nonprofit that provides health care and education to people living in refugee camps in Iraq.
To see what 30,000 people look like in one camp, which is more than the population of the town I live in, it really changed my perspective. A lot of them spoke really great English. They had college educations. They were just like me.
I'm Mormon and Fatu is Muslim. I think we just support each other in the ways that we connect with God.
In March, LDS church leaders launched a campaign called I Was a Stranger, based on the biblical mandate to welcome the stranger, asking members to donate their time and efforts to the refugee cause.
Certainly there's no expectation or hope that people are going to be converting as a result. I do hope that at the end they have a warmer feeling about us and they think, oh, those Mormons are good people.
Don't judge the Muslim. They are not all the same. The same thing happened with us. Like, we thought American people, they're gonna be nice with us or something like that. But no, when we start to know them, they are really nice people.
After 5 years, refugees like Khalud's family can apply for U.S. citizenship. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Salt Lake City.
In other news, 1 year ago this month, world leaders gathered in Paris to sign an agreement pledging to curb global warming. This week, Pope Francis took them to task for not doing enough to follow through on it. Prominent scientists, including physicist Stephen Hawking, attended a Vatican meeting where Francis urged nations to focus on climate change and not be distracted by other issues such as politics. And Francis had another well-known guest at the Vatican this week. Oscar-winning director Martin Scorsese and his family had a private audience with the Pope. They were in Rome for special screenings of Scorsese's new film, Silence, which is about the persecution of Catholics in 17th century Japan. The central figures in the film are Jesuit missionaries. Francis himself at one time had hoped to become a missionary in Japan, but health issues prevented him from doing it. On our calendar this week, December 6th is St. Nicholas Day, which honors the early Christian saint who many believe was the inspiration for Santa Claus. On December 8th, Buddhists observe Bodhi Day, commemorating the day Buddha found enlightenment, according to tradition, while sitting under a Bodhi tree. For Catholics, December 8th is a feast of the Immaculate Conception, which celebrates their belief that Mary was conceived without sin. Meanwhile, Christians around the world are observing Advent, the time of spiritual preparation before Christmas. In Bethlehem, the traditional birthplace of Jesus, the season kicked off with a series of festivities at Manger Square. Germany celebrated the opening of its famed Christmas markets. And in Washington, First Lady Michelle Obama unveiled the White House Christmas decorations. For many people, it wouldn't feel like Christmas time without all the special seasonal music. I looked at the central role music plays in conveying the messages of Christmas.
From the radio in the malls to churches and concert halls, the sacred and the whimsical.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in the one-horse open sleigh.
Christmas music seems to be everywhere right now.
Has there ever been any occasion around which more songs have been written? I don't think so. And, you know, all of that draws us in. Every one of those songs, every one of those nuances, they draw us in. You know what they say? Welcome. Welcome.
For Christians, the religious music of Christmas is central to the season in their faith.
I think the songs embody the meaning of Christmas.
Eileen Gunther is professor of church history at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. She says Christmas hymns focusing on biblical prophecies and descriptions of the birth of Jesus have been part of the church tradition for centuries.
The first carols were in Latin. That was the language of the church at the time carols originated in the medieval era, and the processions would have been sung in Latin.
Today, there can be tension in some churches about when to start singing Christmas music. Those that strictly adhere to the traditional church calendar would not sing carols about the birth of Jesus during the 4 weeks of Advent. They start singing those carols on Christmas Eve and for the 12 days of Christmas that follow. but some congregation members want to start earlier.
They want their children to hear sacred songs, and they want them to hear them in a worship service, not just something on the radio or at home. And if you wait until Christmas and then maybe the family is traveling, they have very little chance to hear Christmas songs in a service.
I really can't stay.
Maybe it's cold outside.
For decades, singer-songwriter Amy Grant has recorded carols and Christmas music that she has written. Five of her songs made this year's Billboard list of top holiday songs. Grant and her husband, country star Vince Gill, do sold-out Christmas shows at Nashville's Ryman Auditorium, where they combine religious and secular music. Grant does Christmas tours with other artists as well. She says music is the fastest way for people to connect emotionally to the holiday.
It calls to something deep inside of us, our collective memory and our longing and hope. And I do think music is what draws people together.
Professor Gunther says for Christians, Christmas music plays several important spiritual roles. First, it helps to transmit the biblical story. For example, the carol, O Come All Ye Faithful.
It's a playlist of all the characters who were there. They're welcoming people to Bethlehem. You've got the shepherds, you've got the angels, and you've got everybody singing in joyful praise, O come, let us adore him.
Based on her own childhood experiences, Grant agrees that music can be among the best ways to learn the Christmas story.
I cannot remember one sermon, not one, but the songs. You know, I had memorized probably 100 hymns, some of them Christmas hymns, you know, by the time I was 10 years old. And to me, that's how we that's how we learn and remember. That's how we get the story.
Gunther says Christmas music also helps impart important theological concepts, often without people even realizing it.
Carols and actually hymns are amazingly succinct theological statements. There is more theology in a few words of poetry than you can possibly imagine. You can have a whole sermon in four lines.
One of her favorites is O Holy Night.
It's a beautiful melody. It's somewhat dramatic. It has kind of an interesting accompaniment. All those are good. But then look at the text, particularly the third verse. Truly he taught us to love one another. His law is love and his gospel is peace. Then this, chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease. I think that is our hope, a hope of justice, a hope of this season. We talk about peace, goodwill unto all people. And this says that so succinctly and so beautifully.
Another favorite is Joy to the World.
Joy to the World is a really interesting song. People think of it as a Christmas song or a Christmas carol. It actually, I hope I don't hurt anybody, but it's not. It's a paraphrase of Psalm 98 by Isaac Watts. As we sing it, it's basically a song of joy.
But new Christmas carols are also being written. Grammy Award-winning gospel artist Chris Tomlin has a new Christmas album, Adore, Christmas Songs of Worship, which debuted at number one on Billboard's Holiday Albums chart.
I have traveled many
In 1992, Grant released her triple platinum album, Home for Christmas, which included the song, Breath of Heaven, Mary's Song. It explored the feelings of Mary as she was pregnant with Jesus.
I realized how universal it was, that we all have that feeling of nobody really knows what I'm going through. But specifically because of Mary's story, I mean, it was the first time humanity actually touched the divine, like in flesh and blood. And I wonder what
to Grant's surprise, the song has become a classic in its own right, often sung at church Christmas pageants.
The songs that I've written come from such specific experiences in my life. And to me, the amazing thing is total strangers singing them, at Christmas pageants. I'm going, wow, music is bigger than... It's certainly bigger than the people who write it.
Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie.
Gunther says she's awed at the timelessness of carols that were written sometimes centuries ago and still feel relevant.
The hopes and fears of all the years, the phrase from O Little Town of Bethlehem, I think anyone who is paying attention to the news today can really relate to that. The times are a little tricky these days, and there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of unknown. The political landscape seems to be forever changing, and I think carols have a really anchoring sense to them.
For Christians, whether the carols are old or new, they help convey ultimate messages of their faith.
The music allows you to feel the presence of hope, the presence of Christmas.
And they say that is what Christmas is all about. Finally, at this time of year, many people of faith try to give extra help to the needy. Churches across the country have been taking part in a special anti-hunger project. Congregation members pack non-perishable meals that will be sent to children in poverty-stricken areas of the world. We visited Grace Community Church in Arlington, Virginia, where senior pastor John Sly said packing the meals was a concrete expression of their Christian faith.
We focus on just three things at Grace: Christ, community, and compassion. And compassion for us is practical service, which is what we're doing here today. Gathered together 1,500 people to feed 100,000 hungry bodies.
Okay, that gong means that we have already packaged 7,000 meals. We are way ahead of schedule at this point.
The meals are comprised of four ingredients: a long grain white rice, soy protein, textured vegetable soy protein. We also have a dehydrated veggie mix: celery, carrot, onion, bell pepper, cabbage, and tomato. And then finally, and probably the most potent part of our meals, is a vitamin sachet pack, which has 21 different minerals, nutrients, and vitamins specifically tailored for malnourished children. And while all these ingredients are added together and cooked with water, it kind of tastes like a chicken rice-a-roni.
Most of those meals are going to go to schools or orphanages. We love the fact that many of them in the past have gone to schools, because parents know there's a good meal for them at the school. They'll send the child to school to get the meal, and then they get the education.
Okay, we're up to 74,000.
What we tell people is to come out to this event, and instead of hearing a sermon in a traditional service, instead of hearing a sermon, they come here and be the sermon. This world is filled with so many problems that you almost don't know where to start. And for us, when you gather a bunch of people together, there's strength and there's encouragement in that. And so what we say here is together we can do more. So we gather a lot of people together so we can make a much bigger impact in a very practical way.
We are now up to 81,000 meals.
When you look at the biographies of Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, there's only one miracle of Jesus that's represented in all four biographies, and that's Jesus feeding hungry people, thousands and thousands of hungry people. So we think this event is so Jesus.
That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and I'd love to connect with you there as well.
Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, more Christmas music from gospel artist Chris Tomlin.
I will bring my life, my love, my all.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.